You're listening to the Body Pros podcast coverage of CROI 2008, the 15th Conference on Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections. The conference took place in Boston, Massachusetts from February 3rd through February 6th, 2008.
As CROI 2008 in Boston drew to a close, we asked Dr. Keith Henry what he felt was the most significant research presented at the conference. Dr. Henry has been involved with HIV care since the beginning of the pandemic, and he is a professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota School of Medicine and director of HIV research at Hennepin County Medical Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota. He has also recently been appointed to the DHS panel for antiretroviral therapy for adults and adolescents. What did you find interesting at CROI 2008, Dr. Henry?
Well, I think there's a shift once again back towards basic science, which has often been a hallmark of the study. It kind of lacks some of the sparkle of big studies of new drugs, but we're still kind of coasting from all the new drugs from last year, and there's a understanding due to the bad news from the vaccine front that we need to get really more basic science behind this before we can approach a vaccine development. So I think it's, again, back to the amazing basic science that's going on.
What struck you at the conference in basic science?
Well, I often don't go to the basic science sessions. That's always a problem because there's things going on simultaneously, and I tend to go to the clinical sessions. I mean, to me, it's a mechanisms of what goes on with the virus interacting with the human genome. You know, there's exciting publications this last year finding a whole repertoire of possible interactions that really will lead to lots of both drug development and possibly vaccine approaches. And it's just amazing. It's a payoff on the genome project, et cetera. So to me, it's the genetics is probably the most interesting basic science. And further dissection of the anatomy of the virus, the amazing photos of what's going on inside the cell, attachment to the cell. And I'm hopeful the next 5 years that'll pay off for some patients.
Uh-huh. And what about in the clinical front? Was there anything interesting at the conference that struck you?
Well, there's a evolving tension almost between results from randomized clinical trials with their limitations and strengths and their very short term of small numbers and results of studies using cohorts where, you know, they combine cohorts from around the world, get large numbers of patients followed for a long period of time and come up with results that really had not been hinted at much in some of the randomized clinical trials. So that's kind of an interesting, you know, development. The most notable, perhaps, would be from the DAD study, the issue with abacavir that came up, linking it to a increased risk, though the overall risk is very low, actually, of cardiovascular disease with abacavir. Another example would be from an Australian meta-analysis that was done by Andrew Carr, looking at, again, what's the best initial regimens and finding DDI falling out as a very strong initial regimen. It's kind of fallen out of favor in most Western countries. So, you know, it's really hard sometimes to dissect out how this happens. But, you know, again, guideline committees often preferentially weigh the randomized clinical trials as the stronger design. So I think there's this tension of how we interpret some of these findings from some of the large cohort studies or meta-analysis, and that's an interesting development to me.
In terms of the results of the DAD study, are you going to change practice because of it and worry more about people with risk factors for heart disease?
Well, I mean, the overall risk is continuing to fall in the study, and I don't think that that's at all convincing. It needs to be confirmed. And again, it's back to the issue of there are biases that get introduced in these studies that randomized trials really avoid. So I think we need to see that confirmed by other groups. But it's a useful way to kind of go searching or fishing for problems that were unrecognized from clinical trials or the adverse event reporting system, which is kind of not well organized in a lot of places in the world, including the United States.
So do you think it serves as an adverse effect reporting system?
Yeah, I think it's a good place to find signals for that. Uh-huh. And individuals, you know, myself included, have your own biases, and you may be having a good experience. Whereas, you know, if you've had a couple of heart attacks with a small number of patients, you'd run around saying that this is a really bad idea. And so how do you basically handle these biases from a clinician standpoint, the biases of clinical trials? And I think the DAD study is just another example of another data set that needs to be considered. But I don't find that abacavir data convincing, but it merits follow-up by particularly other groups.
It's been the talk of the conference, I think. Have you found that a lot of people are talking about that study as well?
Well, again, I think it's more in the context of, you know, the value of some of these large cohort databases compared to the standard reporting system or randomized clinical trials. I mean, you know, back to the Andrew Carr study, in his study, again, it was the DDI regimens that seemed to do the best, and they're not really on the recommended list of any of the guideline panels, as an example. And many of the combinations that have been widely recommended in guidelines kind of fall a little bit lower, including even tenofovir, bacavir, AZT in combination with 3TC or FTC. So, again, that just raises some interesting kind of analytical issues that I think we'll have to grapple with in a couple years ahead, particularly as the number of large randomized clinical trials not sponsored by industry seems to be diminishing because of funding constrictions. I think it's going to be imperative for the research community to kind of weigh the strengths and weaknesses of these sources of information and how to apply them.
So this conference was much more subdued than previous conferences in terms of the kind of news, blockbuster news. We had SMART, and we had all these new drugs. And I understand you have a lot of patients who are on expanded access programs because of these new drugs.
That's correct. I mean, there are several questions you asked me there on the subdued part. When you have kind of the major findings of the Merck vaccine trial highlighted as a presentation, and that not only, you know, didn't work, but sub-analyses, they were able to find populations that seemed to even accelerate transmission. That's very disappointing. And then the vaccine plenaries basically felt that we had to go almost back to the drawing board of basic science. And having listened to these vaccine presentations, you know, since really the inception of CROI, it's kind of deja vu, but it's very disappointing that this is where we're at. So that kind of is a pall that hangs over the whole conference, is that we've kind of maybe gone in some wrong directions. So that's an issue. There's the issue of restricted funding for clinical research in the United States due to budget problems, and that percolates through the investigators as to what they'd like to do. I mean, people are still very interested in metabolic problems, bone problems, renal problems, non-AIDS events that are still related to HIV infection, yet the studies in the United States that are really focusing on that are fairly limited. So there's a frustration that's going on. However, from the patient and clinical perspective, what I've observed and what I hear from a lot of my colleagues, that they're still amazingly excited about all the new drugs. In fact, we haven't even figured out how to use all the new drugs. The new drugs obviously were generally developed in the context of salvage therapy and were available through expanded access protocols. And my site in Minneapolis, thanks to the hard work mostly of my research nurses, offered all three drugs to patients. And we took referrals from the whole region. And basically, to me, it was like 1996 all over again. And I haven't seen that number of very sick patients with highly resistant virus, high viral loads, low CD4 counts, basically in a panic situation. And we would assess their eligibility for Mavroc. You have to wait for the, you know, trophile assay to come back for R5 receptor. That would take about 2 or 3 weeks. And then if they're eligible for that, they would most often get Mavroc and Raltegravir and Etravirine and usually Darunavir boosted and other drugs as necessary, including Fusion. And to make a long story short, essentially every patient that we saw rapidly had a virologic response, sometimes undetectable within 1 month from viral loads over 500,000. And frankly, I've never seen viral load responses that impressive that fast, even in treatment-naive patients. So it was really amazing, and of course, it's nice when the blood tests come back so encouraging, but more importantly, you always worry the patient's going to respond, and when they come in having gained, you know, weight and their skin's better and they got a smile on their face and they're so grateful and thankful, I mean, it was amazing. And that's really the carryover from last year's conference. It's hard to top that. I mean, it's always hard to top what happened in 1996 with heart.
Right.
And there's always, you know, it never was quite the same because we were still so excited about that. Well, this has almost reinvigorated the whole heart arsenal. And we're still trying to figure out where to use these drugs in earlier infection, et cetera. It's going to take years to sort that out. So that's not such a bad problem. It was, you know, last year was so amazing that it's almost expected to be kind of a letdown the following year because we don't have quite the number of new drugs available.
Have you looked at the MERIT study, the Mavroc study, first line? I know when it was first presented, there was some doubt that it was equal to Sestiva in...
Right, and there's still some issues, and of course, at this conference, they looked at, could they have done a better job, you know, screening patients, that some of the failures were due to low-level dual tropic or X4 virus, and so how to really use the more sensitive assay, which is still, you know, incredibly expensive, hasn't been sorted out. But, I mean, if you look at the results, even in the efavirenz arm in that study, it wasn't really all that impressive. And most of us sense that we can do much better with other options. So where that really fits in right now and having to use an expensive assay up front, you know, is really still very unclear to me.
I've heard people talk about induction maintenance with maraviroc. I mean, people are just trying to think of creative ways to use it.
Well, I've been a big fan of induction maintenance for years in our area in Twin Cities, where we've been a stronghold for boosted protease inhibitor-based regimens. We have very little resistance, and that's been the case for many, many years. And often after initial suppression, efforts are made to tweak the regimen to make it easier once a day. Let's say you go from a Cleta regimen to another boosted protease inhibitor once a day option, or even a Sestiva-based option. I mean, we've really been doing very well already. There isn't like a crying need to change our practice. So how a new drug fits into an already winning formula without a really definitive study is still unclear to me, because we really weren't having that many problems before, and we simply have even more options. So I think many of us are just scratching our heads deciding, you know, where we introduce these drugs. It's a really a nice problem to have. And what it really means is that I think patients and their clinicians are very confident that we have an incredibly good, you know, backup safety net should a regimen fail. Again, my view is the biggest problem just maintaining adherence and access to good treatment. And it's not a lack of drugs right now. And it's, what I struggle with in the public hospital is people without insurance, not being able to afford co-pays, unstable housing, mental illness, you know, CD problems. And it's really access issues. And for many patients, the HIV part of their care is almost the easiest thing for me to handle.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know if you had a chance to see the circumcision presentations. What were your thoughts about that?
Well, you know, again, it's good for men, not so good for women, basically. I mean, the data shows, you know, consistently some protection for males in the order of 50% reduction, you know, which is impressive and has been consistent. But it's disappointing because the unanswered question from the earlier studies was, are females protected in some way? And that so far doesn't seem to be the case. And since in the developed world, you know, over half the people getting infected are women, that's an issue. And you also wonder whether the men think that they're protected and get infected, and basically they have a disinhibition of behavior over time because they say, I'm circumcised, I've done all I need to do. That doesn't seem like a behavioral situation is going to be at all helpful for women. So how that plays, you know, remains to be seen. And certainly in the West, the United States, I don't think we're anywhere close to strongly considering, you know, circumcision as a recommendation here in the United States.
Well, it's interesting that there were some small studies in the United States and it did not show a benefit.
Right. So, I mean, there's more to all that than meets the eye. And like I said, the data to me just says that it's not going to be realistically a strong public health, you know, option to consider here in the United States.
Uh-huh. I don't know if you had a chance also to see the HIV and aging.
Yes.
There's been a lot of talk about some of those issues. And are you seeing higher rates of some of the problems like malignancies and non-AIDS related?
Well, I was one of the first to report, you know, heart disease in that setting, and we're doing the CDC Sun study, which is alluded to during that plenary on aging, and that stands for the studies of the unnatural history of HIV infection. It's a study that is focusing on cancer and heart disease and bone disease and renal disease and collecting samples for things that we don't even realize are occurring yet in patients who are doing well on antiretroviral therapy. So this has been a big issue for us. There's also the issue of non-AIDS HIV-related clinical events, and that was kind of highlighted at last year's conference. And once again here that, you know, heart disease, cancer, renal, hepatic, and other issues may be related to immune deficiency tied into HIV. They're not standard AIDS-defining events. Almost all the old research missed that, didn't even count those very well. And so it was kind of missed, and now everybody's looking at that. And so we really need data on those issues, which occur in aging already. And as several of the speakers mentioned, this is very hard to tease out how much of this is aging how much of it is drug, how much of it is HIV, and you really need good, thoughtful studies for large numbers of patients followed for a long time. And again, as I mentioned before, the amount of money in the United States going into that type of research is actually flat or decreasing. And all the excitement tends to be with the new drugs, but these long-term issues, I think, is where the action is going to be in the West. And so we need to, again, think about how to use our scarce resource dollars to learn the most possible for resources which are limited.
Dr. Henry, do you think that because of this heightened risk of heart disease and other non-AIDS-related complications, that HIV specialists are making an effort to educate patients about lifestyle changes they can make to lower their risk?
Again, one of my most frequent expressions in clinic to patients is that you've become boring, you know, HIV-wise. And in fact, there's a study here saying that, you know, we could probably stretch out our visits to 6 months, you know, pretty easily from a cost-effectiveness standpoint as far as checking on adherence and blood evaluation for people that are doing well on therapy. So that gives us lots of opportunity to go back to, you know, something that most specialists are not very good at. In fact, the whole U.S. healthcare system is very poor at, which is primary care. So I've been, you know, focusing on cardiovascular risk really for 10 years. So lipids and diabetes issues and smoking and all those things are really what I talk about more in our HIV clinic than I do antiretroviral therapy, because a high percent of the patients have actually become boring. They don't mind the regimen. They're not complaining about the regimen. They're suppressed. Their, you know, blood test results are fine. And we moved on to really, I think, more pressing health issues as these patients aim towards a normal life expectancy. All the other problems that people have in life are there, and there may be some increased risk for those. That's what we're talking about. And so I think we need to be aggressive and figure out the ways to help the system, which does a very lousy job for that, doesn't reimburse very well for a lot of these things. And that's a struggle we all have, basically. I haven't talked to anybody that has, you know, a wonderful system that's well reimbursed within the United States for providing really good primary care.
So that's a challenge that we still have.
It's a major challenge.
Dr. Henry, I don't know if you read the statement last week by the Swiss AIDS Commission, and I was wondering if you could comment on it. The statement said that HIV-positive people who were taking antiretroviral drugs cannot transmit HIV during sex under certain circumstances. I believe the circumstances were that they had to be in a monogamous mixed-status relationship with the HIV-positive partner taking antiretroviral drugs, adhering to their treatment regimens, their viral loads had to be suppressed for at least 6 months, and the HIV-positive partner could not have any sexually transmitted diseases, a complicated list of things. This statement caused a lot of controversy, and I wondered if you would comment.
Well, I think it's premature. The data is not convincing, and there's certainly maybe some data and some theoretical concerns about what that will do as far as disinhibition for people that aren't in those ideal situations that they alluded to. Actually, there's a lot of people who are in what they think are monogamous relationships that are suppressed, have no STDs in their partner or themselves. So that's the target group that they were referring to. There's a fair number of people that think they're in that situation, and they have not been, you know, well studied. And so I'm very concerned about that, because we're already seeing what we think are increases in HIV transmission in the United States, and we don't do that well with our prevention for positives message. And then this sends almost another message, you know, that I think can be either misinterpreted or seem to give kind of a green light to what we would term unsafe sex. And it doesn't really, it begs the issue of superinfection, which was discussed here, which is a problem, introduction of resistant strains. So, I mean, even in our clinic, when we have couples that are trying to get pregnant and don't have much money and can't use fertility, you know, specialists, et cetera, and we occasionally sanction, you know, unsafe sex during periods of ovulation, sometimes providing, you know, pre- or post-exposure prophylaxis to a partner, but very careful in short bursts to try to get pregnant. And that's something that may be unspoken, but it happens quite a bit under idealized situations to get pregnant. And I think that's an appropriate, you know, venue to do it without resources to bring in a fertility specialist or have sperm washing available. But to broaden it to the more general population in this era where even in Europe, the HIV rates are going up in certain populations. So we're not doing a very good job with prevention. And you know, a focused recommendation like that is so easily misinterpreted by the population at large that it makes that prevention message, which was already not being well acted on, even more difficult for the public to understand. So I think it's premature, and I hope that other bodies will not follow the lead, but that studies need to be done.
Uh-huh. It was funny because it was really blown out of proportion. It was a statement released to physicians in Switzerland, and that suddenly became a global kind of thing. They didn't mean it. They just, you know.
Well, I mean, what world do they think they're living in? I mean, this is the YouTube, you know, everything's on the internet. And that's a, pardon the expression, a very sexy statement to make that I would predict that would be picked up, that some official agency, government, sanctions this. You know, I would be surprised if it wasn't picked up and broadcast internationally and causes actual problems to develop. So these guideline panels and national recommendations really need to be thoughtful these days with as much data as possible. And that's an example, I think, of something that was, for a very narrow set of scenarios, something to talk about in professional circles, but to get released to the public like that, I mean, I think it sends a message. It's going to be hard to reverse the impression that makes on people around the world. Yeah. They don't look at the fine print. They just look at, it's safe to not use a condom if I'm HIV positive and suppressed. And if my partner basically agrees to it, then you know, let's go at it. And I think that's basically almost a dangerous message right now.
Well, I guess before we finish, I guess we should talk a little bit more about mother-to-child transmission. I don't know if you saw any of the stuff there about breastfeeding or...
I have only read the abstracts because they were going on with the current sessions. I mean, it's a very complicated area, clearly, but potentially, again, antiretroviral therapy can fix a lot of the problems that are out there. And one thing I learned actually from last year's conference is that this is the whole idea or issues around breastfeeding are very complicated. And as are formula feeding and options other than breastfeeding also cause their own sets of problems. That was one of the major presentations last year was, you know, when you have contaminated water and other problems going on around you, the formula feeding basically was a disaster in certain situations. So breastfeeding is a good option and how to wisely use antiretroviral therapy.
In the developing world.
Correct.
Right.
And you told me about the issue, which, again, I haven't had a chance to digest, but it's very intriguing about kind of mothers who are chewing food for their children and then basically feeding their children and then cases of transmission apparently through that means. I mean, I have to admit that I wasn't aware that was going on, and more data is necessary. But again, these issues are not going away. Mothers want to feed their infants in the best way possible, culturally and safely, and so these things need more studies, basically.
Right, so there's still things that we don't know about.
Yeah, very basic stuff. I mean, what people are actually doing behavior-wise and how that interacts with HIV transmission, you know, 25 years plus in the epidemic, and we don't even realize that this is happening. It's pretty amazing, but, you know, it's the variety of human behavior, you know, never ceases to amaze me.
There were a couple of other tidbits that I thought were interesting. There was a poster presented about chromium that showed it helped people with some metabolic disturbances. Did you happen to see that?
Yeah, I saw that, but there's been over the years selenium here, chromium there, and it's always very difficult to sort out. I mean, you know, a study on that subject was presented in New England Journal of Medicine, published, you know, several years ago, basically looked at the use of a Centrum-like vitamin versus a placebo in Africa and showing a modest, statistically significant, modest, you know, clinical benefit, but paling compared to, you know, antiretroviral therapy. So even when you have people getting no vitamins and they're deficient versus providing lots of vitamins, yeah, there may be something there, but teasing out which specific, you know, mineral or vitamin has been very difficult. So for almost every year, there's another vitamin or mineral that gets, you know, identified, and then follow-up studies often have a hard time, you know, confirming it. So that's interesting, and I think there's still a lot to learn in that whole area, but let's just say I've been disappointed. It seemed like it'd be so nice to have something simple we could be doing that's inexpensive and likely to be safe. And those studies just need to be repeated by other investigators.
So you're not convinced? By
not convinced, no.
Oh, okay. Finally, I know you have some interest in immune-based therapies, and there were some presentations. Anything interesting, IL-7 or...?
Well, I think perhaps this time next year will be, IL-2 will be the the major buzzword, kind of our major immune-based therapy that's been studied, but no definitive answer has been provided. So three major IL-2 studies are going to be presented possibly at this meeting next year, so including SILCAT and Esprit and immune-based therapy, something that can increase CD4 counts. The question is how safe is it and how effective are those CD4s at preventing clinical problems? So I think that there will be a lot next year on immune-based therapy. Whether it's going to be good or bad, I can't predict yet, but there's still interest in that. Again, it has a struggle because antiretroviral therapy has been so effective that for drug companies to develop it and how the FDA evaluates it, the pathway for immune-based therapy has been a much rockier, difficult one, and there's really been no successful one, you know, approved yet. So it'd be nice to have some good news in that area, and one thing I'm looking forward to next year is hopefully hearing some.
Don't you think that immune-based therapy could be helpful for patients who are immune discordant and their CD4 count just sort of doesn't move, even though they're suppressed, but they still can't get it up? There is a risk for malignancies, et cetera, we see.
Theoretically, yes, but whether that actually turns out to be true is very unclear to me, and there's been hints from small studies that yes, you can get people with lower CD4s, the higher CD4s with IL-2, for example, and maybe there's some modest clinical benefit from that, but they really were not anywhere near definitive trials, and the trials I just alluded to will be, I think, definitive on that, and if positive, will open up, you know, a lot more interest and hopefully funding for immune-based therapies. Mm-hmm. I mean, being on effective antiretroviral therapy and suppressed has a benefit, you know, that's more than just a CD4. People do better with that. So there's a lot more out there than we really understand. So it just tells us why more research is necessary, even in the clinical arena. I hope that this time next year and the years after that, we'll see continued research and new exciting presentations.
Do you have any strategies for patients whose CD4 count doesn't rise very much?
We try to maximize nutrition. We sometimes tweak the regimen to get them off all bone marrow suppressive drugs. Sometimes intensify temporarily to see if intensification helps. That's being studied, you know, by several groups. And we have a few patients that are getting IL-2 and have CD4 counts increased due to IL-2, but frankly, I don't know whether I'm really doing anything for them, and that's why I'm waiting for the results of the trials.
Okay. I think we covered everything.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
The opinions expressed by hosts or interviewees in this podcast do not constitute professional advice, should not be considered substitutes for professional services, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of Body Health Resources Corporation or its sponsors. Please see the full disclaimer online at thebodypro.com. If you have comments or questions, please contact us.
This has been a report on CROI 2008 from The Body Pro. For more podcasts and full coverage of this conference, visit us online at thebodypro.com/CROI2008.